The 100 Years' War, the Crecy Campaign. Preparation for the Crecy Campaign, 1346, Part 1. In February of 1346, a great council of all the lay and ecclesiastical magnates of England met at Westminster to contemplate the coming campaign. In addition, representatives of Edward III's remaining continental allies, the Flemish and the Breton, were also in attendance. However, it was clear that the 1346 campaign would be by English troops and not by subsidized allies. This meant recruiting troops in English provinces on a scale unheard of for a continental expedition. It meant shipping the whole army in requisitioned fleets that were much larger than Edward had needed in 1338 or 1342. It meant gathering food and other supplies throughout the country to supply this larger army and navy. For several weeks, while the men waited to leave England and then to march through French territory, most likely that would be burned or bare of all usable supplies. Of the 2 years' subsidy voted by Parliament in 1344, the first year's installment had already been spent, and the second year's was still coming in. Edward, like Philip in France, had to resort to heavy borrowing from his own subjects. In 1346, we see the final collapse of the Bardi Bank in Florence. One could say that Edward III's credit rating to foreign financiers was pretty much zero, and if they would loan to him, it would require a lot of security, plus high interest. So King Edward began to get his money from within England by going to the church. He selected the 90 richest church officials, and they were assessed in February of 1346 a forced loan of approximately £15,000. Then we move to the towns. Each town was assessed a forced loan, but each town haggled as to what that would be. Then we have the foreign clergy. There's foreign clergy that is beneficed in England. In other words, they've been put on a piece of property that they're supposed to provide prayer and whatever else for. There are English prelates that are in French territory. Both groups are unpopular in each country and vulnerable, not just in England, but in France. So their agents were summoned before the council in early March and invited to contribute an entire year's income to Edward's war chest. They refused, but Edward took it anyway. Then there were a couple of syndicates of Englishmen. One syndicate in May was led by two financiers from London, two London merchants, Walter Sherton and Thomas Swansland. They began to lend money to the government in return for the promise that they would be allowed to take over customs in the fall. They raised money from businessmen in London, from York, and other towns, building an expanding network of financial dealings reaching into the English provinces, swelling the money pouring into Edward's war chest. But money was only part of Edward III's problem, and not even the biggest issue. It was, in fact, far cheaper for Edward to fight using his own subjects than to pay continental allies. Edward envisioned an invasion force of 15,000 to 20,000 men. Now, that's more troops by four or five times than were used in 1338 in the Low Countries, and certainly more troops than had been recruited to fight the Scots. Now he had to raise that army. He did this by embarking on a very controversial experiment, compulsory military service. It's not quite like a draft, and you'll see how it functions. The preparation for this had been going on for some time. In 1345, the English government made a census of lay landowners that they carried out, and they were classified by income, starting at £5 a year and then went upwards. So if you made £5 a year, you could serve as a mounted archer. If you made £10 a year, you would serve as a hoblar, which is light cavalry or mounted infantry. £25 meant you would be a man-at-arms. £1,000 meant you were the leader of 40 men-at-arms, which you provided, and it continued on and on and on. Originally, this exercise had been to update the ancient and rusty system of recruiting troops for the defense of the realm against invasion. In February of 1346, the English government went further as they demanded service in accordance with the assessment not only in the defense of England, but in an army overseas. Those who would not, for their age or infirmity, could not go, they would be forced to either find a substitute or pay a fine. This was a very radical break from past practices. The compulsion had only been limited periodically in the Manning, Edward III's army, and it had never been required of men-at-arms, which was one reason why opposition to the war so far had been restrained and brief. But it's going to pick up a little bit. Then there was the compulsory purchase of supplies during the winter of 1345-46. Just imagine what needs to be gathered up. This turned out to be the largest exercise of its kind that the English government had carried out. Thousands of new bows had to be created. Tens of thousands of sheaves of arrows were requisitioned. They were requisitioned by sheriff's agents and then collected in central storing locations such as the Tower of London, Greenwich, and elsewhere. The accounts, which survive in part, reveal that in Yorkshire alone, 10 mounted men were engaged in assessing, buying, and collecting supplies of food and collecting cash payments. There were 7 collection points at which goods were taken off carts to be packed in the barrels. And those barrels were loaded on the barges, which were then floated down the river to the town of Hull. Outside of Hull, there were 2 mills continuously grinding flour, and warehouses were then hired. Clerks prepared inventories, wrote receipts. Dock workers loaded up ships hired by the Admiralty of the North. Hull handled the output of only 4 counties, Yorkshire, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire, and Lincolnshire. This was then taking place all over England. We just don't have the records of the rest of it. The whole operation was completed with remarkable speed and success. Indeed, more food was supplied to the army that could be eaten before it spoiled. Some of it actually had to be brought back from France and sold off as surplus late in 1346. But we haven't talked about where the ships coming from. How are the troops going to be selected? How do you get out of it? We've given you the basics of it. We'll have to look at that next time. Now, the sources for this are, of course, the Hundred Years' War by Perrault and the Hundred Years' War by Nyland and the Hundred Years' War by Sumption, Volume 1. And as always, I hope you enjoyed that. And don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us by buying some CDs or making a donation or giving us a little donation each month. Thank you very much.